grades and his words.
You know, it probably bothers any parent to read about how Jacob favored one son, but if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. The passage tells us he loved Joseph the most because he was a child of his old age, and what parent doesn't relax a little bit more in the parenting as they get a little older and a little wiser and a little bit more experienced? And what parent doesn't usually have more time? The older we get, it seems like we've learned how to manage life a little bit, so we might have a little more leisure time to spend with our children. And most of us, if we're lucky, tend to feel a little more financial freedom the older we get. So we're not pinching pennies as much with the older or the younger children as we were when the older children were young. So younger children tend to be a little bit more spoiled and receive a few more gifts out of the ordinary than their older siblings did. And we need to remember that Joseph was the son of Rachel, who was Jacob's beloved. It was the woman that he wanted to marry from the day he set eyes on her, and for a lot of reasons and a lot of complications that you can read about in the story, they couldn't get married for quite a while, and even after they got married, Rachel just didn't conceive a child for years and years and years, so it was very special for this couple who was very much in love when he finally was born. But the fact that Jacob showed favoritism for Joseph was not a good thing. It's never a good thing in a family for a parent to show favorites. And because of his showing favorites, Joseph kind of leaned into that, and he became kind of a snitch for his dad, that he would watch what the older boys were doing, and he'd come back and kind of tattle to dad about what they were doing. So the brothers were probably never happy to see Joseph, especially not on this particular day.
So Joseph went after his brothers.
So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father."
But best laid plans aren't always followed. When you've got 10 brothers in on the conversation, sometimes your voice doesn't get heard, and that's what happened here.
Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where can I turn?" Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This is what we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days.
And the sons stayed quiet. Isn't it amazing how family secrets stay secret for years? Of course, the brothers had no idea what happened to Joseph after they saw him for that last time, but I think most of you who have read the story have a sense of what happened to Joseph. And just quickly to summarize it, Joseph, who gets sold by his brothers to this slave trader, heads off into Egypt where he's sold on the auction block to a pretty up-and-coming Egyptian. Jacob enters the household and his leadership gifts are seen almost immediately, and he rises to become the chief steward for the household until he's wrongly accused of an action that he didn't do. But he's thrown into prison anyway. But as soon as he gets thrown into prison, his leadership skills show again, and the prison warden raises him up so that he's actually providing the early or the kind of face-to-face supervision for most of the other inmates in prison. And his ability to interpret dreams pretty soon lands him in the household of the Pharaoh, where again his leadership gifts are recognized almost instantly. And Jacob develops a plan for getting the Egyptians through an anticipated 7 years of famine by storehousing grain from 7 years of abundant harvest that they have. And in his management, not only are the people of Egypt fed during those 7 years of famine, but all the neighboring countries are coming as well. And those years of famine are what led Joseph's brothers back to Joseph. They come to Egypt seeking food because Egypt is known to have these large storehouses filled to the brim, but they get a lot more than they bargained for. They get the fright of their life when they walk in and see who's in charge of food distribution. They're scared to death because they believe that Joseph operates on their same wavelength and that he's gonna wanna get even. And that now that they need his strength, he's gonna wreak revenge.
Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" So they approached Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him, and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to harm me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people, as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them.
Thanks, Candy. Of all the things that Joseph's brothers expected, I don't imagine that that was one of the possibilities. They never expected that Joseph would forgive them. If they would have lived today, they would have seen a Facebook post from one of their cousins, like I saw from one of my cousins this week, that said, "If you think you've blown God's plan for your life, rest in this. You, my beautiful friend, are not that powerful." What is powerful is forgiveness. Each and every character in this story we've just shared is flawed. You see their flaws, especially Jacob's maybe. They've been paraded out so that every generation of our family that comes after him knows that he was a cheating, conniving man. And maybe he got his just desserts when his sons deceive him in the way that he deceived his father a generation before. And no father should ever play favorites among children. That is certainly a recipe for family disaster. And Joseph, favorite child that he was, He was blind to the arrogance and pride that just set his brother's teeth on edge. He had no idea how offensive he was. And we're learning these days more than ever how privilege is something to be shared, not something to be lorded over others or hoarded for oneself. But it took Joseph most of his life to realize that, I think. But the brothers overreacted a little bit, don't you think? Young brother spouting off. They went a little over the top in their response, letting themselves get so caught up in their ugly feelings of jealousy that they commit a heinous crime against the very one that they're called to protect and defend. And then even old Reuben, the guy I used to love when I read this story, because Reuben seemed like the one to stand up for what was right. He's the oldest, he knows better, right? But you read the story a little bit more carefully, and in the end, it appears that maybe he really only wanted to make himself the hero of the story to replace Joseph in his father's good attentions. It's impossible to be free of sin in human relationships. It was almost comical in the newspaper this week as I'm dwelling in this story of Joseph to read a letter to Dear Abby from a young man who wanted to know what to do when his little brother drives him crazy with his obnoxious bragging whenever he beats him at a game. And I thought, well, if I were writing the response, I'd say, read this story about Joseph. And in the Guthrie's exceptional production of Sense and Sensibility that's on right now, the story starts when the brother inherits everything upon the father's death and is so quickly seduced by his wife to shut his mother and his siblings out of any inheritance at all and eventually boots them out of the family home. These things happen. This stuff between siblings is real. This story takes up 13 chapters of the Bible for good reason. If we read it carefully, each of us will see ourselves in one or more of these characters. And if it's not sibling rivalry that motivates some of our most hurtful actions, it's self-serving ambition, most likely. Yet our humanity binds us together. We can only be fully human if we're fully in relationship with others. It's through our interconnectedness that we are most who God created us to be. We're interdependent beings created for fellowship, created for relationship with each other. So if our behaviors tear into the fabric of our connectedness, we will feel hurt, and repairs must be made to those relationships in order for all of us to be made whole. Whether it's a parent who neglected me, or a sibling who abused me, or a spouse that betrayed me, or a child who disobeyed me, forgiveness is the only tool I've got that can help me repair the relationships that have been broken. Forgiveness is not an easy thing, but it's the only thing in the end that can bring the kind of freedom and future that Joseph and his brothers made for each other in their acts of confessing the wrong and asking for forgiveness and forgiving. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in his book of forgiving, shares two simple truths. There is nothing that cannot be forgiven. And there is no one undeserving of forgiveness. It's so important, I want you to hear it again. There is nothing that cannot be forgiven. And there is no one undeserving of forgiveness. As one who chaired South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission following the fall of apartheid, Tutu has a little bit of credibility when he speaks about forgiveness. Forgiveness, we all know, is a complicated thing, but there are some things about it that are universal, and Tutu in his book really gets at the heart of those. He says, when there's hurt, when there's sin that comes into a relationship, each of us will experience the same kinds of feelings. We'll feel sadness, we'll feel pain. We may feel anger, we may feel shame, or a combination, or any or all of those things. When we've been hurt, that's what happens. We respond with emotional pain. But every time we're hurt by another person, we always have a choice. Like Joseph and his brothers did, and in the story of Joseph and the brothers, we see both choices played out and the consequences of those choices. We have the choice to retaliate, to get even, to hurt back, or the choice to reconnect. And what you'll find is that the choice of retaliation never is as fully satisfying as you want it to be. You may have relief for a nanosecond, but the pain of the hurt that's been inflicted on you doesn't disappear when you hurt back. Retaliation doesn't take away your pain. It's not a way to resolve your problem. As Gandhi said, when we practice the law of an eye for an eye, we all end up blind. So instead of inflicting hurt like the brothers did, we need to become vulnerable by sharing how we've been hurt, and we need to leave ourselves open to see things from the other's perspective, to see maybe how the one who has hurt us is also hurting, that they're also vulnerable, that they may be acting out of a pain of their own that we know nothing about, or some kind of brokenness, or simple ignorance. Through forgiveness, we get to write a new story in which we are no longer the victim, but we are the one who learns and grows and continues to thrive, even if we've had really awful experiences at the hands of other human beings. Tutu encourages a process that's fourfold in the path of forgiveness. The first step is telling the story. The second step is naming the hurt, what happened as a result of the actions of the other. The third step is granting forgiveness. That might be the hardest step, and we may come back to it again and again. And the fourth step is renewing or releasing the relationship. So very quickly, by telling the story, we begin to understand and make meaning out of our pain. In telling the story, we can reclaim our dignity, that this story doesn't define us, it's something that happened to us, and we can articulate exactly what happened. When we tell stories about the hurts that have come our way, we build our resilience. When families share stories of some of the brokenness of the past, they're building resilience in their children. And I think what a gift we have in Scripture, that we have so many stories like this story of Joseph and his brothers that teach us that we are born of a people who is resilient and who can move beyond hurt and pain and suffering. When we decide to tell our story, we may start simply sharing our story in a journal. That might be a safe place, or maybe we have a safe friend or pastor that we could share our story with. But there may come a time where we'll be bold enough to share our story with the one who's hurt us. Joseph does that in a passage of Scripture that we didn't read today. Joseph articulates exactly what his brothers did to them, and they hear him name the hurt. Naming the hurt requires that we express our shame, our grief, our sadness, our loss, to name what we lost when that action affected us. And we need someone who can listen to us with love and empathy and hear our pain fully out of us so we can get the burden of that pain outside. And if you don't have a trusted friend or pastor that you can come to share that pain with or to name the hurt, you can always go to God to name the hurt and know that God will accept it. from you with love. And then we're called to grant forgiveness. Granting forgiveness isn't saying it's okay what happened. Granting forgiveness is freeing ourselves from the bondage of living locked in that story and locked in that pain in a never-ending spiral of suffering that will take us down. And I think it becomes possible when we think of the other as vulnerable as we are and think of the other as operating out of a different set of values, a different family story. And again, you might have to circle back and forgive again and again and again to finally be free of it. But you'll know that you've forgiven when you start to feel a sense of lightness in your own being, or when you no longer feel like that one owes you a debt that they haven't paid, or when you're able to wish them no harm, or maybe even to wish them well in their lives. You may not want to be part of their life again or have them part of yours, but you get to the point where you wish them well. You wish them healing and a better future than they've had with you. And then you move on to renewing a relationship. Doesn't mean that we return to the way things were. We never can, because now we have this shared story of pain and suffering between us. But oftentimes, like in marriages that last a long time, when conflict after conflict is addressed and resolved, relationships can grow stronger and deeper when we respond to each other's confessions and forgivenesses. The process of forgiving has the potential to transform any relationship and bring it to a new level of connectedness, supportiveness, and care. Renewing relationships after the relationship has suffered a hurt isn't always possible. We may not want to re-engage with people who have hurt us. We can still wish them well. We may not want to be in relationship with them, or sometimes the people who have hurt us die and we don't have a recourse, or they move away and it's no longer feasible to think that we can have the kind of reconciliation that we long for. And so we can release the relationship, and in releasing the relationship, we simply refuse to let that experience or that person hold space in our hearts or in our heads any longer. It lets us free that spot of resentment that we felt and release any debt that we're holding with that person, so that hate can no longer have the final word. That's what happened in Joseph's story. He doesn't let hate have the final word. He doesn't let vengeance have the final word, even though he was in a perfect position to wreak vengeance on his brothers. In the end, the final word was God's. It was God's goodness. God used it for good. God's goodness will always have the final word if we let it, because God will always forgive us and God will always support us in gifting forgiveness to one another. Thanks be to God.